the trenches matter. I'll take less money and a good campaign team over a billionaire and, you know, helicopter, you know, dropping tons of lit on neighborhoods, you know, every time. It's not like, oh, San Francisco politics is a parlor game. We all like to just sort of sit back and have a drink and just sort of watch the show, like the opera or something with our monocle. Like, why, look at these freaks go.
Welcome to the very first episode of the Voice Weekly Podcast, coming to you from the Voice of San Francisco, a new nonprofit independent news source that launched on April 15th, 2024. We figured people needed something to cheer them up on tax day. I'm John Zipperer, editor-in-chief of The Voice.
And I'm Melissa Kane, political analyst, lawyer, and all-around nerd. John and I will be your co-hosts for weekly explorations of San Francisco politics, people, and issues.
Each week, we are going to introduce you to some of the people responsible for San Francisco today. Some of them will be names you know. Others might be folks you haven't heard about, but who have interesting stories or roles in the city by the bay.
We'll also offer background and analysis, explorations of controversial trends, people and actions, and sometimes we'll open the hood of the car and explain just how and why things work the way they do or don't work.
We're kicking off our Voice podcast with a look at some provocative data, trends, and analysis of San Francisco elections. In early March, San Francisco voters made some decisions that have been interpreted as a shift to the right, or at least a shift toward the center, depending on how long you've been a Fox News host.
In post-election coverage, we saw headlines like these. Voters make it clear San Francisco can no longer be called a progressive city. San Francisco approves public safety measures in backlash against progressive agenda. San Francisco revolts. Those are from The Chronicle, Washington Times, and New York Post. Our guest today is steeped in the history and, importantly, the data of San Francisco elections. And he says, not so fast. Maybe this March election wasn't an outlier.
His name is David Latterman, and for 20 years, he's done deep analysis of San Francisco elections for campaigns, community groups, and others. He recently retired, but he agreed to look at the data from the March election and share his thoughts. Here is our interview. David, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So there's a narrative that San Francisco has shifted to the right, or what passes for the right here, really what we would call progressive to moderate. But what do you make of that?
Not really. I think in this past election in March, the city has voted how it always would have voted. There's nothing that I saw that was particularly different. If you look back over many years in San Francisco, I mean, the city tends to vote for doing something about homelessness. So that wasn't any surprise. I mean, that goes back to Care Not Cash, to Sitlai. You know, the police stuff, I mean, obviously Prop C, the one that got kind of nixed by everybody, that doesn't count. But the one, what was it? It was E. Sorry, I'm just checking here. It was E, yeah, the policies and procedures. You know, that would have passed, I think, in any, it would have been close, but I think it would have passed in any iteration. So, you know, the city kind of is up and down about different issues, but on these kind of quality of life issues, by and large, it's a consistent vote. So it's not that the city moved to the right. It's just that somebody cleverly put on initiatives that they knew would pass and they could use them for political gain, or they could use them to craft a political narrative.
And absolutely, we had 2002, we had Care Not Cash that limited the amount of cash that homeless people could receive, sort of by counting the city's resources against the amounts. And then, of course, in 2010, we had Sitlai, which banned sitting and lying on public sidewalks from, I think, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. each day. That one, I think, is tied up in some legal wrangling. But so you're right. I mean, we've got this sort of history of passing ballot measures like this. But then we also turn around and we elect folks who do very different things. So how do you square the fact that on the whole, you know, we do pass these things regularly as San Franciscans, but then we have the sort of reality that is in the city?
District versus citywide elections, for starters. The political figures who are certainly who, again, tie up auditing and would be considered on the certainly on the farther left side of things, are almost all citywide elect. I'm sorry, are all district electives, whether it's Ronan or Preston or Connie Chan. I mean, and that's that goes back 20 plus years. That's kind of been the nature of our district politics, depending on where people live. And then citywide, almost without exception, people vote for the more moderate candidate. The exceptions are often political quirks, like you think about Jason Bodine, and that was an RCV kind of, that was a bit of a mess when Mercurimi got elected, the same thing. So, I mean, there you have sort of the long time discrepancy between how the city votes in big picture issues and then how district elections go, and they're often at cross purposes.
Well, and that's it's such a great issue too, this idea of citywide versus district elections, because I think we're going to be looking at some ballot measures that address this and try to sort of make it into a hybrid potentially, where we have a couple of citywide seats, some district seats, and people on both sides of the argument think that maybe citywide elections would help them. For example, my understanding is that Dean Preston has come out and said, you know, that citywide elections would be a good thing for progressives. Meanwhile, of course, people in the business community think it would be helpful. What does the data actually say about who citywide elections help and who district elections help?
I know there's been polling on it. I know people have kind of played with it. By and large, district elections are popular. They're more popular than you think they are. People do not want to give up their own representative. Whether they like their soup or not, they do like having one, and they do like that more direct, close line to city government. I think it's going to be difficult for the city to eliminate district elections entirely. Hybrid, from what I understand, hybrid is mixed. I think people are kind of gaming it. They're thinking, like, what's in it for me? I do fail. I think if there are citywide positions, I don't see how that helps progressives. Going, you know, back to what you just said about why, like, Republicans may have endorsed district initially because they probably thought they could get some people elected in maybe D7 or D2. And that was a long time ago. And obviously the city has changed greatly from how they would have imagined it. So I understand why Republicans would have wanted to go district then. But if you look at the data over many, many years, citywide is always kind of collectively more conservative than district, or at least some of the districts. So I think, you know, if you're putting the progressive hat on, citywide is not good for them. I don't see it because the city does not have a record for a long time of electing citywide progressives again, unless you get like a one-off like Bodine. But obviously that didn't turn out well for him either. So the data shows people do like their soup. They like having a representative, whether or not they like their particular representative. But I don't think a lot of people are going to want to give that up, especially if you live in like in one of the outer neighborhoods where you feel kind of neglected or forgotten, you know, to have less of that direct line, I think was going to be problematic. So the devil's going to be in the details for hybrid. If they pull that off, it has to be really cleverly and well constructed to appease most people.
There's these judges elections as well that I feel like, because they don't necessarily fit this narrative of a swing to the right, it doesn't get talked about as much. but this is now the second time voters have rejected attempts to attack judges or to replace current judges. We had a few years ago a sort of challenge from the left with some public defenders trying to take some judge spots. And now we've had sort of the opposite this time around. And both times voters have rejected that. Is that other evidence of sort of more of the status quo for you?
Well, there's nuance. I think people want to believe that judges are good. I do think, given how the March elections went, the judges not doing the challenging judges should have done better. And I don't know if that's a campaign error, if the people running those campaigns did a bad job. But given how the DCCC vote went, given how the citywides went, that one should have been, maybe should have been different. So I wonder whether that was a true citywide political feeling or whether that was a campaign error. And it's tough to know.
Yeah, you just mentioned the DCCC, the Democratic Party County Central Committee. That was a place where moderates did significantly well. Why is that important? And why would people even know about this thing? I mean, it seems like such a weird place for so much energy to have been placed and for the vote to have been as solid as it was.
Well, I mean, it changed for, I can give you two words why it changed. It's Todd David. I mean, one person single-handedly flipped it. We have known the DCCC has been very important in this city for a long time. It just, and it's sort of the most important thing that nobody knows about, or that isn't true, but that few people really think deeply about. And because it's the Democratic Party, because it's sort of the official word of the Democratic Party, and the city is overwhelmingly Democratic, their word matters. What they say, what they endorse, that slate card that they do matters a lot. And so to get the stamp of approval from the party, to get their endorsement matters. Not every time and not every race. But on balance, you want that endorsement. And candidates who say, I don't want it, it isn't true. The last four, you know, maybe the last 12 years, it has been run. It was run by the far left for a long time in the mid-2000s. Then it was flipped in 2010. And it stayed moderate or so for about 3, 4, 5 years. That coincided with Ed Lee. So, you know, they got a good little run going. And then it went back to progressive. And it collapsed. Like the moderate, it just collapsed. Like the people running those campaigns trying to change it just failed year after year. And so it was always understood by moderates that we got to do something. But no one was able to put it together. Nobody was able to create the campaign to change it. And Todd ran this campaign and putting a lot of money into it and a lot of lessons learned from other campaigns to flip it. And it was a concentrated effort. You know, everything happened by design. It was not happenstance. Like this is, people had been thinking about this process and how to do this correctly for years. And then finally, one person got both the wherewithal and the experience to pull it off. And so, you know, we'll see. And here's a nice test. Okay, now that the board, the DCCC has changed. So will it make a difference? You know, what it does, you know, in the real world today, it keeps Peskin from getting that endorsement. That would have been a fait accompli had it still been a progressive DCCC. Who gets it now, I'm not sure, but it's not going to be Peskin. And that's something that he could have counted on.
And one of the things about running for DCCC is because there's a fundraising issue. Isn't that right? So if you run for DCCC at the same time you run for a different seat or position, you can kind of get a spillover benefit based on your DCCC campaign. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yes, I like this, using the word spillover. That's a very nice euphemistic way of putting it. And having been involved in these efforts, if a lot of candidates run for DCCC in the spring, they're also running for supervisor or some other race, and they're not allowed to legally take money from one into the other, but putting a big DCCC campaign together in the spring certainly is helpful toward your supervisorial or other ambitions in the fall. And so a lot of candidates would raise and spend a ridiculous amount of money for a little county seat in order to bolster their name and just get themselves out there for fall races. And that's not going to change. I mean, that's sort of what we do here. And I know people have had ideas about rule changes and money changes. And obviously you can't use one source of money for another, but name recognition is name recognition. So that's a tried and true practice in San Francisco. And I don't see that changing by anybody anytime soon.
And there are no campaign contribution limits on the DCCC, right?
Unless that's it's right. changed. So, in the last couple of years, it wasn't. And so people could donate tons of money. And so what some candidates and some people would do is use it as a slush fund. And you would see, it was one of the things David Campos got in trouble for, in the sense that he would say no to every developer, no to housing, no to everything. And then he would take developer money for a lot of it for the DCCC races. Or Peskin would do it. And suddenly, he would orchestrate other people doing it. And suddenly you'd see little deals made. And so it's used as, a nice little kitty for other people to directly donate money to them. And so you can only donate $500 for a soup race. You can donate a whole lot more for DCCC. And so it was kind of used as a workaround. And, you know, moderates would do it and just sort of shrug and say, yeah, this is what we do. Of course, we're going to take money from real estate developers. But you would see progressives do it when they wouldn't touch some of these places with a 10-foot pole publicly, but they take a ton of their money for DCCC. I think that, you know, in that assembly, the last assembly race with Campos and Haney, that came to light.
So if you're skeptical about there being kind of a political zeitgeist change in San Francisco that you know, drove things at the ballot box, would it be safe to say your take is that it's really a reliance on the strength of the campaign managers and the campaign organizations? And if so, has the moderate, political strategists and such been a weak bench for the past few years?
Very weak bench. But I don't think the zeitgeist is cyclical. I mean, the progressives came in 2000, Newsom wins. You know, we have progressive leadership on the board from all the 2000s. Then Newsom goes away, but Ed Lee comes in and the board flips in 2010. And then it flips back. So there is absolute cyclicity in this. That is just, that's human nature. Like, we do that nationally with Democrat, Republican. So there are natural cycles in this, absolutely. And of course, issues change. When things are going well, people are more broad-minded. Like, okay, let's do more about social services and other things. And then it kind of might lean more progressive. But when the money gets tight or crime goes up and stuff gets bad, they want a more conservative leadership. And again, that's San Francisco. That's everywhere. I think the big, if you want to talk about a zeitgeist change, I think it's housing. I think the YIMBY movement really changed some things in this city. I think that was an issue that you could no longer ignore. I think when they came, their ascendancy came, I don't know, when was it, 8 to 9 years ago, they really pulled off making that issue forefront and sticking with it. And it is now a major issue in this city. That has been a sea change in how we think about issues in San Francisco. And that's a difference. So I don't know if there's an overall zeitgeist change into who we are, but I think issues have changed some narratives.
So this might be another narrative that you can blow a hole through or not, but one of the narratives is that the Asian American vote in San Francisco has been burgeoning, and kind of, we saw it kind of come out of the closet with the Chesa Boudin and the school board recalls. Is that overstated? If it's real, do you have any thoughts on its staying power? What do you think about that?
Well, it came out of the closet, as it were, really for Ed Lee. That was when that block, for it's not a monolithic block, let's be fair. I mean, there are as big a differences left and right in that group than there is anywhere in any other group. You know, whether it's Chinatown or Portola or Viz Valley or the Sunset or the Richmond, there are different kinds of voting there. So it came out really in 2010 when Ed Lee had that block. I mean, that was a 25-30% group of voters that were lockstep. And I worked with David Chu then, and we just knew that that vote was going to go with Ed Lee, and that was the end of it. It was almost an unwinnable race once Ed Lee decided to get in back in that race in 2011. It was done. The numbers just showed the Asian vote enough to have a 30% block of anything is really strong. And so fast forward, without Ed Lee, the group, the block kind of went back to its separate ways, and they vote on other issues. It did reemerge with the recall, but so did not just them, but a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an issue in which that community pretty much universally agreed on. But again, so did a lot of people. And so today, I think that bloc, there's no single mayoral candidate who that bloc is going to support unilaterally. You know, I think you'll get a lot of Chinatown folks, obviously, are going to support Peskin, but the rest will go every which way. You won't see Peskin support on the West Side.
I mean, one of the great things about you and your work and Fallen Analytics is the very detailed maps that you would create, the progressive voter index that you created, and it would sort of show the heat maps of where certain groups are. And I know that you no longer do those for every election, but I was wondering if you saw anything in the data, the neighborhood data, or anything else in the election results that you thought was interesting or a departure from what you might have expected. Are there any neighborhoods that are moving around or changing or voting in ways that you might not have predicted? Or are we still basically the same enclaves?
By and large, we're the same enclave. So first, I got to give credit to Rich DeLeon, who invented the Progressive Voter Index back in the late 90s. I took it over. I worked with him in 04, and then I think I took it over by 06. He bequeathed it to me. And by and large, no. Like, it's remarkably consistent. And I did one of the last big research projects I did was looking at PVI changes for 20 years. And I was even surprised how little this city has changed as far as political geography. And it was sort of one of my academic interests was like, do neighborhoods change people or do people change neighborhoods? And that's a big, in political science, it's always a big question. I think in San Francisco, it's like neighborhoods just impart their values on people. But generally, no. I mean, I can look at the maps. I've got it up here and I can see like, okay, Noe Valley maybe, you know, did one thing a little bit differently, but it's always been kind of a swing middle area. But for the most part, you can almost just clock in exactly how areas are going to vote. The question is by what degree. So even if you look at algebra, it's a silly policy thing, passed overwhelmingly, and you look at the map and it tracks exactly like every other left-right issue. Now, the degree is different. So even like the least algebra precincts are still clocking in at 70%. But if you look at the pattern, it is really consistent. I mean, ridiculously so. And that's why the PVI was just such a stroke of genius, because it really is predictive. I mean, it's not just like, hey, look what we did. That's interesting. It was, you know, I used it in campaigns for years. You know, it works. And again, I can, and even with that, all right, I can point out a couple of neighborhoods like Noe, maybe like the Inner Sunset, where there's your swing district. That's how I would use it in campaigns. Like, okay, for this, for a housing issue, for a crime issue, here are your kind of influx areas. But like, by and large, it's really consistent. Yeah, I look at like SF policy, the SFPD kind of, and, you know, Noe was kind of in the middle. Everything else tracked exactly. The Inner Richmond kind of was a little different. That was kind of a no there. And then the drug screening stuff, though Noe kind of came in much more strongly for it. So there are, short answer, no. No big anomalies. Longer answer is I can see in these issues what districts were a little more gradational. And if you're going to campaign, you're going to be like, okay, here are your swing areas. Like D5 is like, you know how they're going to vote in D9 and D2 and D7. Locked in, no question. Like, you want to play around and try to like convince some people, you know, there's D1, D8. So, yeah, I mean, it works. And in 20 plus years, it has not changed a whole lot. D6 has changed. Submission Bay has changed somewhat. You know, that's a neighborhood that it's from Soma to Mission Bay. Yeah, okay. 15 years, there's been some changes there. But by and large, man, we haven't changed much.
That's our program. And thank you for joining us. Please catch us every week for more of the people and topics that matter to San Francisco. And check out our sister podcast at The Voice by John Rothman, offering his daily commentary on San Francisco.
You can find John and me each week wherever you get your favorite podcasts or directly at thevoicesf.org.
The Voice Weekly is a member of the Voice of San Francisco Podcast Network, all rights reserved.